Welcome back to the third hour of Issues Etc. We'll spend a few minutes here talking with Mary Ann Hackett, president of Illinois Right to Life. The story appeared in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. House OKs bill aimed at abortion clinic demonstrators. We'll be talking about that for the first few minutes. Then we'll turn our attention to the thoughts and the musings of Uwe Simonetto, religion editor for United Press International. We'll talk with him about Peter Arnett, who gave the, he gave an interview to Iraqi television recently and was fired by just about everybody. NBC, National Geographic, and I think it was MSNBC, all three gave him the boot after trying to talk their way out of it. They gave him the boot. He's a man without a country and a man without a news agency at this particular point. We'll also talk about the media coverage of the war with Uwe Simonetto, and we'll touch a little bit upon something he recently wrote about the United Nations. That's the remainder of the program. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Mary Ann Hackett is our guest. She's president of Illinois Right to Life. Mary Ann, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you very much, Pastor.
Tell us about this bill that passed the House in Illinois.
Well, it's an outrageous push to add more penalties, always more penalties against the pro-lifers. I don't know if you saw the coverage when the Now versus Shidler decision came down from the Supreme Court, but Faye Clayton, who was the lawyer for Now, kept trying to undermine it as a victory, saying it really wasn't a victory. We always have faith. We still have faith. And it's clear that they intend to try to pass faith all over the country to restrict pro-lifers, but they don't need to. There's already a federal law. This is an additional punitive act against pro-lifers. And the federal law has enormous penalties as it is. I think it probably, in light of the Shidler decision, will be declared unconstitutional, but it's hard to tell now with the courts.
Now, tell us about, let's zero in if we could. Starting with the federal law, you mentioned that there is a federal law that,
yes,
that deals with clinic access.
Yes, and the federal law provides fines up to $25,000 and prison terms even as long as life for violence. Violence or obstruction of abortion clinics. So why do they need a state law?
Well, answer that question. Why is it that lawmakers are so intent, to the tune of 62-49, at least in the House in Illinois, in passing a law that seems redundant?
Well, it's redundant, but also it seems to me like just an attempt to restrict pro-lifers from even speaking to any women at any abortion clinic. And, you know, the bottom line clearly is, for the abortionist, is money. When the pro-lifers speak to the people and turn them away from the abortion clinics, the clinics lose the money. And that's been their incentive all along to pass this restrictive legislation. Unfortunately, the government, the legislators, are in cahoots with the abortion industry.
Now, if there is, I'm trying to draw a parallel here. If there is, say, a union dispute regarding, say, a convenience store,
right,
and or a, let's say a grocery store, that's kind of current with the St. Louis situation, and union members picket or demonstrate outside or near that grocery store,
right,
that is the kind of protected free speech demonstrations that most citizens expect to enjoy. What is different, at least according to the Illinois House, about, and the grocery store might lose some business as a result of this,
right,
but what is the difference, according to the Illinois House, with regard to abortion protesters?
Well, because the people don't care whether their groceries sold, but they definitely care whether abortions are sold. Abortion is the issue here, and the abortion industry has financed a lot of legislators. At the election time, they give them big money, and then they expect them to dance to their tune, and they seem only too willing to do it. And, you know, it seems, I was shocked to read the figures, 62-49, 62 people in our state house think that that pro-lifers should not be allowed to talk to a woman seeking an abortion. And, you know, all they do is offer them help and information. And they always are always talking about violence. There is no violence among peaceful picketers or sidewalk counselors. There's no violence. What they're anticipating, it just doesn't happen.
Now, is this, so it sounds as though there might be an attempt here to perpetuate a stereotype.
Of course, and when the media, whenever the media covers prayer vigils or anything at the abortion clinic, they always describe it, even though you don't see anything on the screen indicating violence. They describe it as the radical protesters, the violent protesters, the barricades. They draw a whole picture for the public to imply that we're a violent group, which couldn't be farther from the truth. It simply isn't true. And you know, your analogy with unions, there is often violence connected with the union pickets and strikes and things like that. It's frequently reported in the paper. There isn't violence among the pro-lifers who go to the clinics to pray and sidewalk counsel. There just isn't violence. Then how would it serve us if we're seeking to help a woman and turn her away from the violence inside the abortion clinic? How would it serve us to be violent on the outside?
Now, the paper says that this bill, after passing 6249 in the Illinois House, goes to the Senate and, of course, then on to the governor's desk.
Yes, right.
What do you think will happen, Marianne?
Well, since the election, and the state is run by the Democratic Party, I don't know. There are Democrats that are pro-life, and I hope they have the courage to vote against this. But in any case, I think it'll be tested through the courts, because it's clearly unconstitutional to punish one group of protesters. For instance, the People for Animal Rights can go up to you if you're wearing a fur coat and throw blood on your coat, and nothing happens to them. There's no bubble zone for animal rights people.
So is the solution here to broaden these kind of laws to apply to all protesters, or to allow abortion protesters to go with the free access that are afforded other demonstrators?
Well, I think that's the American way. Is our country was built on protests in March. You remember the Boston Tea Party was a protest, and it's a history of our country, the suffragettes and the labor unions, and that's the beauty of a democracy. Look at what we're acknowledging and seeing now, the anti-war protesters. I mean, that is the beauty of a democracy, that we have the right to speak for the things we strongly believe in.
All right, I'd like your reaction. This is a statement made in the paper by the information director for Hope Clinic in Granite City here in the St. Louis area.
One of the major killing centers, I might add, in Illinois.
Monday, this director of information is quoted as saying, "There are between 4 and 40 protesters here every day. They shout anything they can think to stop women from entering the clinic. They prop their signs on the sidewalks, they stick their bodies inside the patients' cars trying to hand them pamphlets." And she says that these protesters frequently, if subtly, block access of women trying to enter. Your reaction?
I think my reaction would be, I'd like to know how many women they're able to turn away from abortion. I think it's the bottom line that they're losing their business. And I think there's no doubt that these women are not being informed about the developing child or their rights to be informed or the damages of abortion once they're in the clinic. We have to reach them before they go in the clinic. There is no law requiring informed consent or women's right to know in Illinois. It's been defeated, and when it's brought up, never even got out of the committee. So how else can these women be informed of the damage that they're going to incur inside if no one speaks to them outside?
Could you give us a lay of the land? We can see the numbers for the Illinois House. What about the Illinois Senate? Is it more or less pro-life?
Well, in the past, I don't know what it is. It's a big question mark since the election. In the past, the Senate has been very good on pro-life bills, but partly because Paige Phillips was the head of the Senate, and he's no longer in the Senate.
And what about the governor, Rod Blagojevich?
Blagojevich has essentially promised the pro-aborts that he'd sign this type of legislation. So our only recourse then will probably be to go through the courts to have it declared unconstitutional. It makes you wonder why everybody in the country can protest the pro-lifers.
Now, before there was Blagojevich, there was, of course, Governor George Ryan. Did Illinois pro-lifers make a mistake in voting for Republican George Ryan 4 years ago instead of a Democrat Glenn Pashard?
I think they did. I think Glenn Pashard was clearly a pro-life and a man of integrity, and who, in fact, he had always been pro-life. Even when he was in Congress, he was denied jobs in the Democratic Party leadership positions because of his pro-life stands. And I think George Ryan claimed to be pro-life, but the first opportunity he had to prove it was to stop the Medicaid funding of abortion, and he vetoed our bill. So I think clearly it was a mistake, and I can tell you I myself did not vote for Ryan because I didn't think he was trustworthy when he was running.
Mary Ann Hackett, thank you for your time. Thank you for being our guest, and keep up the good work.
Okay, thanks a lot. Good luck to you, too.
Mary Ann Hackett is president of Illinois Right to Life. They have a website you can visit for yourself. It's Illinois Right to Life, all one word, illinoisrighttolife.org. Their telephone number, area code 312-422-9300, area code 312-422-9300. For the remainder of this third hour of Issues Etc., our guest is Uwe Simonetto. He's religion editor for United Press International. We'll get his thoughts on Peter Arnett, on the media coverage of the war, on general war coverage, and embedded, this is an interesting one, embedded reporters, and we'll also talk a little bit about the UN and a few other things that have been on the mind of Uwe Simonetto lately. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Uwe Simonetto is religion editor for United Press International. Welcome back.
Happy to be back.
Let's start out with Peter Arnett, if we could. Tell us the story and your take on this. Well, if the media wasn't enough of the story itself, Peter Arnett certainly pushed the media to the front pages.
Well, he certainly did. I mean, he went, as you know, he had been fired previously for what I think are unpardonable offenses to journalists and had been fired by CNN. Now NBC and something else sent him up to Baghdad. And there on public television, on Saddam Hussein's television, he says, well, you know, they had to change, the Allies had to change their war plans because the Iraqis fought so well. Which is, if you translate this into, say, World War II terms, imagine a Western journalist would have gone into Nazi Germany and told the Nazi radio, listen, you guys, you're doing very well, you're fighting so well. It forced the Allies to change their war plans, and you know, this guy would have been hanged on his way back back to the West. And so I've known Arnett since the Vietnam War. We were there together in the 1960s, and you know, he's made a considerable career for himself by consistently arguing and reporting against the interests of the very country whose audiences he's talking to, has been writing to.
Well, this raises the general question regarding what the offense was. I mean, obviously NBC, National Geographic, Explorer, and MSNBC found it a fireable offense after a couple of days of mulling it over.
Sure.
But as a journalist, what's the primary error he made? Was it giving the interview or what he said during the interview?
No, it's not giving the interview. I mean, you are in some place, even during a war, you can give an interview, but once during that interview, you are arguing against the interests of the side that you are reporting to, it's totally unethical. Of course, if the guy had had the guts to say, well, this war wouldn't take place if your president, Saddam Hussein, would like to take a first-class ticket out of here and say to Libya. Of course, he would have then had his toenails pulled for the rest of his life by the Iraqi Secret Service. But that would have been gutsy. But I mean, there's nothing gutsy about saying what he said. It is against the interest. I think it is totally unethical for a journalist. And you know, I've been a journalist for 47 years, so I think I'm arguing from that perspective.
Well, but given the what we know about the ability and the willingness of the Iraqi news media to use any opportunity towards propaganda,
sure.
No matter what Arnett said, didn't he realize or shouldn't he have realized that what he said would be used, twisted, edited to the ends of Iraqi propaganda?
Yeah, sure. He wasn't a spring chicken. He's 68. He's been in the trade for a long time. He knows exactly what these guys are up to, and he's done it anyway.
All right, tell us about, you mentioned that you spent time with Arnett during the days of the Vietnam War. Tell us about his coverage there.
Well, in the beginning, of course, his coverage was very courageous. I mean, like the rest of us, he was, at least like those, he belonged to those of us who actually went out with the troops, who slugged it through the mud and through the jungle and through the rice paddies and all that sort of thing. And he did a remarkable job for which he correctly earned the Pulitzer Prize in 1966. Then, of course, during the Tet Offensive in 1968, he reported from a town called Ben Tre, quoted a major, an American major, saying that we've had to destroy the city in order to save it, which to many of us sounded very bogus. Normally American officers wouldn't say that sort of thing. Secondly, he was not named, which is quite remarkable under those circumstances. And thirdly, Ben Tre, as we later found out, and especially a Los Angeles Times colleague and friend of mine found out, was not at all destroyed. I mean, it had, yes, 20% damage to the city, but Ben Tre is still standing and was alive. So, but this particular quote, whether it was correct or, as some of us suspect, bogus, influenced significantly the American and worldwide public opinion. And made them believe that that really what the Americans were doing in Vietnam was foolish and irresponsible, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Now, we were talking about Peter Arnett, and of course, following fast upon his heels, not to be outdone for the spotlight, Geraldo Rivera, kind of acting unilaterally over in Iraq, has also been griping a lot on cable television, and he's the more egregious example of journalists making themselves the story. How tempting is it for a journalist to begin to think that they are, in fact, the message?
Well, it's extraordinarily tempting because they become stars. I mean, there are people in the electronic media, but also in some of the printed media, who can command tens and tens of thousands of dollars for just one lecture, for example, up to $70,000, I know, in one particular case. So, you know, if you make a fuss of yourself, and I think Geraldo, I don't think he was as ill-willed as Arnett was, because Arnett has made a career out of this, but Geraldo was a fool. You know, he's a lawyer. Knows a lot about lawyering, I suppose, but he doesn't know that you do not draw tactical plans into the sand for everybody to see, including the Iraqis. But I'm less angry with him. I mean, this is very much part of the type of journalism which I suspect is going to ultimately destroy Western democracy as we know it, because journalists are no longer craftsmen, they're showmen. And if journalists stop being craftsmen and become showmen, then they no longer fulfill their mission, as we Lutherans would say, they do not fulfill their calling from God to serve the neighbor out of love. And that is my main gripe with this.
What is your general assessment of the idea of embedded journalists, and how do you think it's actually working out in practical terms?
I think it is working out well. Listen, it is only a variant of what we went through in Vietnam. We used to join units, we weren't consistently with one particular unit, but then the war was much longer, but, you know, I was out for a time for 2-3 weeks with one particular unit in combat, etc., and lived with them, ate with them, and suffered with them, and etc. I think it is the only honest form of journalism. It's not the only perspective, but it's the only truly honest form of journalism, of frontline reporting. These guys know who the soldiers are. They know the military impact. They don't obviously know the political impact. That's not their job. They can tell you about the human interest, about the human suffering, all of which I believe the reader and the listener and the viewer is entitled to. And I think, for example, I'm watching CNN, and certainly on that score, I have some other complaints with the coverage, but on that particular score, I think they're doing very well.
What is your overall assessment of the news coverage of the war up to this point, Uwe?
I think basically the news coverage that I've seen so far is much better than what we got towards the end of the Vietnam War. In the Vietnam War, I must say, my complaints are against mainly the electronic media rather than the printed press. What I find bad, and which what reminds me much of Vietnam, is this sort of Monday morning quarterbacking nonsense. You know, when they say, "Oh wait a minute, did they stall it? They're not stall." And then you know these ridiculous debates during briefings, which I must say, this general there, this briefer, is seems to handle very well. You do not speculate, and after 11 days or 14 days now, you do not know which way the war is turning. You cannot be a strategist. You're not trained to be a strategist if you sit there in a cushy chair in Doha. But that is my only complaint. And here, of course, you know, they have to talk and talk and talk to fill airtime. But basically, I think the reporters in the field, what I've read and what I've seen, are doing a wonderful job. At least on this side of the Atlantic, somewhat different in Europe at times and in the Arab world.
I'm wondering if you share the impression that I've been gaining over about the last week and a half, and that is, at first there seemed to be the news coverage, in particular the television news coverage, wanted to depend largely upon not only embedded journalists, but upon retired military personnel, in particular generals and colonels and the like, to give them the analysis of the news, to put it all together in a cogent way. But as the week has gone by, it seems the more reasonable voices among those retired military people have been shuffled off, and the ones that say the stupidest things have been kept on the air because, of course, we all like watching people say stupid things.
Yeah.
Do you share that assessment with regard to the retired military?
No, it depends on what time of the day you watch. You see, I watch on at different times. Sometimes I wake up in the middle of the night and switch it on, and sometimes, you know, obviously I'm curious to see what they say. Yes, at times one has the impression that the screwballs are again on the screen. But I've noticed that even today and yesterday, there was some very, very good analysis. It really depends on how lucky or unlucky you are when you flip on your television set. And I tend to watch now CNN because I think it is actually quite consistent in its coverage, and has some excellent analysis in addition to dozy analysis. But by and large, I would say it's better than. Much, much, much better for the time being. I mean, let's just hope it's going to continue. Much better than 35 years ago in the Vietnam days.
Is it standard in journalism schools and among journalists, and I'll need to get your answer to this on the other side of the break. We're talking with Uwe Simonetto, religion editor for United Press International. I'm curious whether or not it is standard for journalists to be taught that, especially in a time of war, they're kind of they kind of renounce their citizenship to a certain degree. I'm putting in crasser terms than it needs to be put, but that they are citizens of no country, that their allegiance is to journalism in some general sense, to the story, and not to the country under which they are rightfully citizens. We'll talk about that.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Is the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ historically reliable? And what can we learn about this miraculous event from extra-biblical sources? You'll find answers to these questions with the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April, the very first Easter. The book is published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about this book on our website, issuesetc.org. And click the What's New section, issuesetc.org. The very first Easter is written by Dr. Paul Meyer, professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University. It's a great Easter gift for your children or your grandchildren. The book costs $12.99 plus shipping and handling. The very first Easter, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House at 1-800-325-3040.
Tree frogs, riveting evidence for creation.
Answers with Ken Ham, one of the editors and contributing authors to Creation Magazine.
Well, Ken, that was a pretty bad pun, but is it true that tree frogs have a number of characteristics that evolution just can't explain?
Well, they sure do. Let's take a really good look at the marvelous design features of this tree frog. For instance, frogs' eggs don't have a hard shell to protect them and keep them moist. So laying eggs like these in trees would quickly lead to dried up eggs and, well, no more tree frogs. But you know, God provided for this by giving them a special way of protecting the eggs. The female frog covers the eggs with a layer of bubbly foam, and the male beats it into a lather with his hind legs, kind of like beating egg whites, if you like. After the foam has been beaten, the outer layer dries and keeps the eggs inside nice and moist. Then the eggs can hatch into tadpoles. Now, evolution can't explain how the female developed the ability to produce the foamy layer of protection, or how the male knew that he had to beat it into a lather. Evolution doesn't have answers for these sorts of problems or any others. You see, God, not blind chance, designed and created life.
But did God create over 6 literal days, or was it over millions of years? It's a question many Christians ask today, which Ken Ham goes into depth on our website. Go to AnswersRadio.com and read Ken's lengthy booklet on the 6 days of creation. You'll be encouraged in your faith when you go to AnswersRadio.com.
Uwe Simonetto, religion editor for United Press International, on the uniqueness of issues, etc.
I want to know how a Christian is to lead a useful life in this demented world. Sacraments with Jesus talk is not enough. Issues, etc. is the only radio program I know that gives me intelligent theological answers. It balances law and gospel beautifully. It tells me that God calls us even into this perplexing era. It is a program for thinking believers.
You can support the worldwide outreach of Issues, etc. by making a tax-deductible gift this week. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Or you can make a credit card donation by calling our resource line at 1-800-737-0172. 1-800-737-0172.
You've heard the saying, all things being equal, friends buy from friends. Well, it gets even better when your friend sells you something for a much lower price than other people are paying. And Lifeline Long Distance is a Christian company, so we'll donate 10% of every long distance call you make for the advancement of the gospel. Hey, after all, what are friends for? Lifeline, long distance with a higher calling.
To sign up for Lifeline Long Distance service and benefit AM 850 KFUO, call 1-800-607-5128.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. 25 minutes remaining in the program today. We'll spend those 25 minutes continuing our conversation with Uwe Simonetto, religion editor for United Press International. If you'd like to join us with a question or a comment, feel free to do so. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. For the next few minutes, we'll continue our conversation about the media coverage of the war in Iraq. I asked the question before the break, Uwe, regarding journalists and their mindset. Is it standard among journalists to consider themselves, especially at times of war, citizens of no country, no national allegiances, in order to do their job as journalists?
This calls for a multi-layered answer. You can never be a citizen of no country, however. You are not a propagandist for your own country. You cannot be, because otherwise you would not be fair. You would not. Your first allegiance is to the truth. Your first allegiance is to your informing your readers truthfully about what you have seen. Having said this, of course, that immediately follows is followed by footnotes. But you cannot say everything you've seen, because you might put people in harm's way. You might cause incredible damage or even death to the people you are covering in a wartime. So therefore, that is that has to be considered. So you can't. There are certain things, many things that I have seen in Vietnam, for example, horrendous things that I could not truthfully cover, because I would have exposed other people to death. You wouldn't want to do that. there's another problem, and that is, for example, let's take the Peter Arnett case again. Yes, if you are doing a commentary, if you comment on a situation, and you have to distinguish clearly between commentary and straight reporting. But if you are called as a commentator and analyst, yes, you are allowed, you are even obliged and obligated to criticize your own side on your program, not on the enemy's program. That's another thing. Secondly, whenever you have something to criticize, you still have to consider and, if necessary, discuss it with others, either with other journalists, preferably with other journalists and your own newsroom, or even with competent officers, whether or not your particular criticism, your particular report will endanger other people, especially the troops at the front. You know, so therefore, the question of loyalty to one's own country is obviously relativized by your loyalty first and foremost to the truth. On the other hand, of course, responsibility towards your fellow man.
Is there a liberal bias in the news media?
There has been for a long time, and there still is in wide sections of the media. On the other hand, there are also media that have a right-wing bias, which can be equally unattractive. If it's hard right-wing, I don't find any of these biases particularly appealing. There are also, you know, if I look at my colleagues here at UPI, who are out there in combat and risking their lives for infinitely less money than, say, an NBC or a CBS correspondent. They go out there seeking the truth as far... We're talking about, obviously, secular truth here. Seeking truth, wanting to be as fair as possible and not being biased. And this, Todd, I must hasten to add, was also the case among most of the correspondents, the much criticized correspondents out in Vietnam, those who were with the troops, those who were in combat, those who were, like I, were wounded or shot down and held at the hands of dying soldiers. Those try to do their very, very best to be fair to the side they were covering, especially to the men they were following.
If a liberal bias in the media persists, is the answer, from a Christian perspective,
a
Christian news media with its own slant on the news to counterbalance the liberal bias?
No, definitely not. I would oppose that. I think journalism is decidedly a vocation in the kingdom to the left, in the secular kingdom. When, as Luther says, about ruling the rulers in this world, that a wise Turk he prefers a wise Turk over a Christian fool. I would prefer a wise Jewish correspondent who does his job well over a foolish Christian correspondent who wants to inject Christianity. The Christian religion in here. There is a place for Christian coverage, for religion coverage, which is what I'm doing. But when you are out there, you know, those bullets and those rockets and those mortar rounds have no denominational bias.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, Uwe. Go ahead.
Yeah. No. I mean, one has to make this distinction. There is another. When I go around and I teach a lot in journalism schools and others, and I say, I don't want you to be Christian journalists, but I want you to be Christians in journalism. And then, even to non-Lutherans, I would explain the doctrine of the two kingdoms, and I would say, now you are here. You've been put into this world, into this job, by God, to serve your neighbor out of love, and then you're rendering service to God. But you serve your neighbor the same way as you would if you bake the best bread you can bake, or if a baker bakes the best bread, or the farmer produces the best potatoes he can produce. That, I think, is where the limit stands. Then, of course, there is the totally different side of religion coverage, but that does not necessarily apply to the general coverage, say, of the war like the one we are watching now.
We're talking with Uwe Simonetto. He's religion editor for United Press International. By the way, you can read Uwe's columns on the internet at upi.com. That's upi.com. Type Uwe, U-W-E, into the search engine, and there you'll find his columns at upi.com. Uwe, let's talk a bit about the war protests. I understand from one of your columns that you had a run-in with a certain anarchist, as you refer to him.
Well, he was. He was right outside my building. I have to say, maybe this is my theological shortcoming, but it doesn't say in the scripture that you have to be nice all the time. I react very allergically to people covering their faces. You know, if you have something to say, say it with your open face and do it. Well, here outside my building, I don't know why, these are just where I'm living, blocks of apartments and the hotels here, and that's it. You know, we are suddenly run into a demonstration, and here are these anarchists, self-declared anarchists, clad in black and having their faces masked. And one of the guys, I said to him, listen, why do you cover your face? Why can't you show your face and do something? And he just lifted his mask and sent a huge gob of spittle into my face. And unfortunately, I couldn't. He ran away so fast, I couldn't grab him. Otherwise, I may have done something very unchristian. I would have placed my two hands solidly around his neck. But I didn't have to do that. So he ran, and then to my wife's delight, he fell flat on his face. So maybe he, of course, I forgive him. But maybe he will remember that this is not the sort of thing you do without some consequences. You know.
What is the tenor? As someone who is watching these things and obviously seeing these things a little more firsthand than middle America, what is the tenor of the war protests as you compare them not only with the other kind of protests you've seen, but in particular the anti-war protests of the Vietnam era?
Well, much of the anti-war protest now is deriving its rhetoric from the Vietnam era. And in fact, when you look out, look at the crowds, you'll find some of those graying hippie types of the 1960s teaching them all the slogans, you know, make love, not war, and all that sort of stuff that one heard back in the 60s. That is one thing. Then there are some people like those anarchists that I encountered, who are just troublemakers and who actually are blithering fools, but they are dangerous because they are endangering themselves because they might be mistaken or might indeed be terrorists and suffer dire consequences if they're perceived as such. Then you have your pacifist Christian groups who are nice and friendly and they chant and they smile at you and all that sort of thing. But when you then say, well, can you give me a good answer from your perspective of how one should handle or cope with this problem that we have in Iraq? And of course, they never have an answer. There is not much logic to it. Right now, I would say the anti-war protest, at least in this country, is relatively benign. That may not, as compared with the 1960s. And of course, there are no drugs in war. At least I haven't noticed any here. All that stuff might come again. I don't know. But the tenor is actually one of a sort of general goofiness. That's the way I can really describe it.
And from a journalist's perspective, are the war protests here in America being over or under reported?
If anything, they're overreported because they are not, in America at least, they're not that significant. And because you have the usual players. If anything, are overreported, but I don't think it's excessively overreported. You have to take note of them. They're there, and they do block the roads, and they do have their banners, and they do influence certain politicians. I mean, what I find very, very troubling at times is when, for example, they they raised, as they did in Maxine Waters out in California and others, they suddenly raised the racial issues and then put that sort of thing up, which can be very dangerous. And if that is being reported, then yeah, there might be backlashes and all sorts of things that we certainly don't need.
You spent time with the troops during Vietnam at probably the height of war protest in of all the decades of war protest in American history. What effect did it have on the thoughts and the morale of those who were fighting the war?
Devastating. And in two ways, Todd. I mean, I did two things. First, I spent time with them, a lot of time with them, in combat, and very heavy combat. And then, of course, I worked as a chaplain intern among Vietnam veterans, all of whom had been called baby killers within the first 24 hours of coming back here, and some of them had been expelled by their churches, by their congregations, and pastors and priests saying, do not dare to show your face here or show up here in uniform or with your crew cut or that sort of thing. But you see, what most Americans do not remember or do not wish to remember is, for example, the inhumanity the civilians have shown towards these fighting men who were, most of whom were draftees, who had no choice but to go, and being sent, for example, videos by their girlfriends in bed with some bearded peacenik, that sort of thing. You know, the Dear John letter syndrome, which was very, very prevalent. I know of one particular case where a guy, having received a video of his girlfriend in bed with a bearded peacenik, going out and started shooting at random and killing God knows how many Vietnamese, ran amok after that. That sort of thing, where I squarely blame certain churches here who participated in this, who vilified these people, that sort of thing has to still, I think, be worked on historically and ritually and in many other ways.
Let's go to the phones, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Roland, thank you for waiting. Roland's calling from his car. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
Well, good afternoon. You know, being a first-generation German-American, you know, if you cut me, I bleed Warsteiner. That's how German I am. I cannot believe the condition of the German people today, especially on this issue of Iraq and the Iraqi war. I saw a poll reading on the web the other day that Joschka Fischer is supposed to be the second most popular politician in Germany today. Now, if everybody thinks back to the 60s, and Uwe, I'm sure you remember Joschka from his good old days.
Very well, man.
He was a Molotov cocktail-throwing, long-haired anarchist himself, and now he's the foreign minister for Germany. What is going on? You know, it sort of brings a new meaning to the phrase nutty Bavarian when you watch what goes on.
Roland, thank you for the call.
Yeah, it's a wonderful question. I'm glad you've asked it, Roland. Yes, it distresses me greatly, and it distresses me even more if you know the details. For example, the latest polls show that only 11% of the Germans consider the Americans their best friends. 6 months ago, it was 70%. What has happened here is, there is a German saying, which you, Roland, probably know, Angst ist ein schlechter Ratgeber, fear is a bad advisor. And this is precisely, I mean, when Germans are suddenly taken over by their fears and their anxieties, anybody, not just Germans, they react totally irrationally. And then, of course, you have to realize that if you complain about the liberal bias in the media here, you should see what the 1968 generation have done with not all of the media. The newspapers tend to be okay, but television, news magazines, etc., etc. They've been hammered day in and day out with anti-American propaganda by these left-wing people. And then, of course, in addition to which, now the left-wingers from West Germany, whom we all thought dead and gone and buried in shame, are now revived by this and are linking up with the East German left-wingers. And of course, even the non-communist East Germans were exposed to this constant anti-American, anti-Western propaganda. It is an extremely distressing situation for which I cannot find any answer. It has to be really considered from a lot of perspectives, sociologically, theologically, spiritually, etc. And another thing is, since Germany, the Germans by and large, have given up their faith, there's no standard for them to hold on to. They're out there full of fear, the type of fear that as a Christian you shouldn't really have. But they are full of fear, and that I think influences their comportment considerably.
Lester is calling from Overland. Lester, thank you for waiting, and welcome to Issues, Etc.
My question is as follows. I'm not a Christian, but I learn a lot from these programs. Can you explain to me the universal opposition of the corporate Christian church, i.e., the Catholic Church is represented by the Pope, and the National and World Council of Churches representing Protestantism, against the president and against the war in Iraq?
Thank you, Lester. And Lester, keep listening to Issues, Etc. We're glad to have you as a listener and a caller as well. How do you square this, the Pope and the National Council of Churches, World Council of Churches?
Here we have to differentiate. The Pope, who is also the leader of a global institution and has to deal with a global institution, actually played this. If you read the Pope's statements on this subject, you'll find that he's very nuanced. That he says we are not for peace at any price. And then, of course, you know, he comes up with his statements. But it is theologically grounded, and, of course, you also know from the other perspective, that's the institutional perspective. If you look at the World Council of Churches, and especially the National Council of Churches here, well, you're back in the baby boomer 1968ers clause. These are ideologues of the 1960s who are now having a field day. There is, except for bona fide pacifist churches like the Mennonites and the Quakers and the Amish, etc., who have that theology, most of us Christians, whoever we are, do not have a strictly pacifist theology. We do have a just war doctrine, especially the Lutherans, but the others as well, which are being totally ignored. So there is a knee-jerk anti-Americanism, anti-Western attitude here that is the outgrowth of the 1960s.
To the issue of the UN, you have a hard time explaining and understanding, as I do, the position of the Germans. What about the United Nations? You formerly served as a UN correspondent.
Yes, I was a UN correspondent, and for one unfortunate week, I actually worked in Geneva as a consultant to the United Nations, an experience I never, never, ever wish to repeat. That was the most horrible experience. I really lost faith in my fellow man for a while there. I tell you what, the United Nations, if you looked at it, if you looked at the bluster, the posturing, the stuff that goes on there, the lines of argument, for the World Council of Churches, or indeed for the Pope, to more or less canonize the United Nations is absolutely impossible. You know, it's one of the most corrupt outfits I've ever seen. Now, I'm not talking about the United Nations people and the specialized organizations who are out in the field, who are doing very often a significant job. But, I mean, anybody who's ever spent as much as a quarter of an hour inside the United Nations at the Delegates Lounge in New York or its equivalent in Geneva would tell you this is absolutely absurd.
So the United
Politicking,
So the United Nations as a whole, you say, does not merit canonization.
No.
But you're still willing to admit that on the periphery it is doing many good things in the world.
Well, it's more than the periphery. I mean, there are many things, and I would certainly not plead for the dissolution of the United Nations. They have done a lot of good, but in this particular case, for example, they have totally failed. And for 12 years now, and 17 resolutions have passed, and they have never enforced them. There's no punch behind what they're claiming, which is one aspect. There are very, very, very good people out in the field at times, whether be it UNICEF for the children or whatever you have. World Hunger Program, and all these things, who are doing very good work, except, of course, again, their administrators and the bureaucrats and the headquarters in New York and in Geneva are wasting most of that money and most of the time and are full of self-importance and big good food.
Uwe, before I let you go, I'd like to invite you to listen to the Internet tomorrow, to the program on the Internet tomorrow, because we're going to be in the first hour, 3 o'clock our time, I think it would be 4 o'clock your time, we're going to be discussing Bach's St. Matthew's Passion with Robert Barrett of the American Contrarie.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm looking forward to it.
Uwe Simonetto, thank you again for being our guest.
Todd, all the best, and talk to you soon. And greetings to your listeners.
And to you as well. Uwe Simonetto is religion editor for United Press International. You can read his columns on upi.com. Just type his first name, Uwe, U-W-E, into the search engine there, and you'll see Uwe Simonetto's columns on upi.com. Folks, Easter is just 18 days away. Now, that's plenty of time for you to order our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April for your kids or your grandkids. It is out especially for Easter through Issues Etc. It's called The Very First Easter. It lays out in a very understandable and a very enlightening and in-depth way the events leading up to and surrounding the death and resurrection of our Savior Jesus Christ. The book is called The Very First Easter by Issues Etc. regular Dr. Paul Meyer. You can order the book online tonight at our website, issuesetc.org. That's issuesetc.org. When you get there, click on the What's New section, and you'll find information on this book, the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April, The Very First Easter. The book costs $12.99, and I would encourage you to order it in advance, of course, of Easter as an Easter gift for your kids or your grandkids. You can also have the book by calling Concordia Publishing House tomorrow during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. That's 1-800-325-3040. Ask for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April, The Very First Easter by Dr. Paul Meyer, 1-800-325-3040. Regardless of what one thinks about the war, or the protest, or the coverage, there is a solid ground upon which the Christian takes his stand. Even when the bias of the media seems to be turned this way or that, and I think more often than not it's like a pendulum swinging, depending on what channel you're watching, whether or not the war seems to be going this way or that. The perspective of someone like Uwe Simonetto teaches us that wars come and wars go. They do their damage, and they do even do their good. But one thing remains unchangeable, set in history, that gives the Christian his hope and his perspective, in spite of the fact that he doesn't feel like he can get an accurate perspective here or there in the media, and sometimes he does. But even when he thinks he's getting the straight story about the war or the protests or the politics surrounding it, the perspective isn't supplied by our bias or their bias, but by the cross of Jesus Christ set firmly in history, wherein we know the good purpose of God for us and for the world. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.